So, welcome to the Futile Podcast. Tonight, I've got Daniel. Hi, Daniel. How you doing?
Hi, how's it going?
Pretty good. And you're coming from East Coast?
Yeah, I'm in Harlem.
Okay, right. New York City. So it's 3:15 for you. It's noon for me. 12:15 for me. We're just having this conversation through the amazing space-time. How is it in the future?
It's okay.
3 hours in the future, yeah. Okay, well, that's good. So tonight, we're going to talk about Hellraiser. I guess Hellraiser 1 and 2. Those are the two I've watched, though I've seen 3 a long time ago. And I think there's something ridiculous like 9 of these. And then comic books, and I don't know if it was originally based on a Clive Barker book or anything. It sounds like you know a little more about it than I do, so I'm going to kind of be the secondary on this one and give you the reins, and you want to kind of discuss Hellraiser in the framework, it looks like, of the Cenobites and the sort of philosophy of the Cenobites, I guess.
So you're gonna Siskel to my Ebert here?
Yes, I will. Okay, fine. I'll list this goal to your Ebert. I will be. You get the Pulitzer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, what is the deal with Hellraiser?
So I should say that I only watched the first two movies a year ago, last October, and it was after a philosophy conference that I was doing with my buddy Patrick down in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. And it was the conference was on morals and nature, or ethics and nature, something like that. But all of the papers were on moral realism. We were talking about Hellraiser through the lens of moral realism, and we started having some ideas, and I've sort of built on those ideas.
Moral realism?
Moral realism.
Okay, is it just being pragmatic about things?
No, it's being realistic about things. So the idea is that there are moral truths that certain things are true or false about morality. So you can be an anti-realist about morality and think that there are no moral truths; they're just things we make up. But the moral realist believes that there are moral truths. The conference was about this sort of loosely. I'm not a moral theorist. I don't really talk about moral philosophy. But I wanted to talk about Hellraiser in this light. So like I said, I don't have any like deep history with Hellraiser. I only saw the movies last year. I haven't watched any movies other than the first two. I did read the comic books, which are pretty cool. And yeah, you're right that it was based on a Clive Barker book, The Hellbound Heart. And the book and the first movie, they're really sort of necrophilia movies. The woman seduced by like the zombie.
Gothic horror romance, as some might
say,
right?
Yeah, that's right. So maybe I can start. I don't have a whole lot to say about the movie as a movie. Right. I really want to take the sort of the metaphysics of the movie world.
Okay.
And then use that to do some philosophy.
Sounds good.
So the talk is called "Are You a Cenobite? Identity in the Cthulhu Scene."
Okay.
So I'll explain all that stuff.
Yes.
but because it's a feudal podcast, maybe I should talk a little bit about movies. And maybe the way I want to do it is by like throwing some shade at that other podcast. I listened to that other podcast. It was a good conversation, and they sort of talked about the...
You're talking about Paul Chapman's Greatest Movie Ever podcast that I sent you a link to? Yeah.
Yeah, those guys are good guys. And they gave some good analysis. There were some things that I disagreed with and that I just wanted to clarify.
Okay. Go ahead.
So they only talked about the first movie, and then they sort of shat a little bit on the second movie, and then they really shat on the rest of the movies. I assume the rest of the movies are really bad. I don't know the rest of the movies, but the second movie, I think it's at least in the fan world considered a partial canon. Barker executive produced that one, and then gave the rough outline of the story, and it was done by other people. But the main actors in the first one, Julia and Kirstie, are in the second one also. And so it's sort of a continuation of the story. It happens immediately following the first movie. So I think it's okay to sort of group the first two together and think about them together. The comic books are also done by Clive Barker. They're written by him. And they go more into the hell stuff. But one thing I wanted to critique about the podcast was they kept saying how it's better to say less about the Cenobites. Less about their backstory, right? Revealing that they used to be humans, like It makes them less scary. They should be in the shadows. But I think that goes against the sort of philosophy of the Hellraiser movie, even the first one, right? When Cenobites come out, they're in like fluorescent lighting, where you can see everything. I mean, they're in hospital lighting, right? It's in the hospital room. Yeah. So they're not trying to hide them at all. In fact, they're completely revealed, and that's part of why they're scary. I mean, they talk a little bit about how the Cenobites are following rules. I mean, I guess this is really where the story that I want to tell jumps off. So you should feel free to interrupt me and ask questions and comment and.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my experience with the films, just to kind of jump onto that whole thing, is okay. Good. I should have just used the hashtag I invented when I live tweeted my viewing of Hellraiser, which was "Owlraiser, lads." So first off, where the fuck is this movie taking place? Are they in England or not? Because most of the people in the movie don't have English accents. It's very confusing. But that's like a movie complaint, and maybe that's not where we want to go. But just to kind of cover all that real quick. So, Pinhead is iconic thing people know about, blah, blah, blah. So I was aware of Pinhead. I think I saw maybe three on Cinemax, staying over at a friend's house first years ago. And then one was on Sci-Fi Channel on some Friday back in the day when Sci-Fi Channel was a little more, I don't know, risque or whatever. And I remember watching a good bit of it and being kind of like, I guess kind of confused by the whole thing and being like, okay, so it's more about this like woman and this guy she used to have an affair with, and it's not about these, S&M creatures torturing people or something, but it is. Yeah, so I don't know. I feel like having watched, and I watched one and two back to back one dinner. I force fed them. So
That's the
I
right way to
agree.
do it. That's the right way to do it.
I feel like it might be. And I agree with you there. I think that there is a pretty sound continuity between the two, and there is further development, obviously, and you've just got to kind of got to do that. I still feel like the Cenobites live in a place of, it's not like they completely flesh them out. They do sort of hint at these things about them being human. You get kind of a more objective sense of Pinhead as a, I don't know, a soldier in World War One, or I don't know what that's supposed to be, but.
Yeah, no, that yeah, that's all right. That's all right.
And then you get into the sort of, I guess, interpretation of what this potential hell dimension might be. And I feel like that's still relatively nebulous in terms of its definition. I mean, they use the term Leviathan, which is a biblical term, but they don't quite get like super like, oh, this is actually hell. It's so there's still an aspect where the whole idea of what is it? The puzzle box and the Cenobites can still kind of, I think, pretty soundly reside in kind of an ambiguous realm where people can apply what they might want to them from a philosophical standpoint on some level. I think attributing them with specific people and sort of establishing this factory, if you will, for where new ones are created is which they do in two. Does kind of maybe added a little extra. I mean, I could see it as being a way that adds depth or as a way that kind of demystifies. So I can see, Chapman and his boys' interpretation there being kind of like a little disillusioned, if you will, by the further explication of the Cenobites in terms of their origin. But like you said, you can go either way with it, and you can, like you will do, really get into it, or just kind of be. Find it unremarkable.
I mean, they in the other podcast they acknowledge that there's some strange things going on in this film that don't just make them like. I guess I should wait for that siren.
If you could close a window, I don't know. I don't know if it would help.
No, he's gone right by my window. All right.
Harlem, everybody.
Yeah.
It's not just the California anthem anymore.
In the other podcast, they're good about acknowledging that the Hellraiser's a different kind of horror movie that doesn't really fit into the other. I mean, it's weird, right? Because the like you said, the main part of the movie is this love affair with this decaying, like a dead person, right? The Hellraiser, right? Frank is the Hellraiser. The Cenobites aren't Hellraisers, right? Cenobites are Cenobites. So in like the fan world, most of the discussion is about sort of like hell, but also hedonism and how pain and pleasure mix, the sort of sadomasochism stuff, and like how torture can be pleasurable and stuff. And it doesn't they sort of mix that kind of hedonistic worldview with sort of like sort of naturalist ethics. I don't really have much to say about the. There's not a lot of people talking about the metaphysics of Clive Barker's world here. So, for one thing, just that the Hellraisers are different from the Cenobites, and the Hellraisers are doing different things from this, right? So the Hellraisers are people that are dead that want to come back to life, and the Cenobites are people that are turning other people into Cenobites. So, like, different agents have different functions, they have different powers. It's sort of this fantasy world, but it's not, dwarves and elves. It's Cenobites and
And
Leviathan. And
Hellraisers.
Hellraisers, and
Kind of like
okay,
the Matrix in a way, right?
yeah, that's right. So I kind of wanted to lay out how I understood the Hellraiser metaphysics, and then how that can be useful for talking about metaphysics in this world. So I'm going to go ahead and jump into
Go
the
for
talk.
it.
Are you a Cenobite? Identity in the Cthulhu theme. So just to start, the word Cenobite comes from koinos bios. Koinos means common in Greek. Bios is life, so common life. It's a word used to describe monks who sort of segregate themselves from civil society and are sort of devoted to a religious way of life. Okay, so common life. Cenobites are monks,
But
and
would you say they're like sort of very, they're rigorously fundamental in their dogma, I guess?
So
And that's why
the
they're segregated?
yeah, but it's but the dogma here isn't ideological. It's really lifestyle. It's this ascetic tendency where like self-denial, right? So you don't wear any fancy clothes, you don't party or anything like that, right? You're sort of devoutly devoted, and it's not ideological, right? So there's not like a theory underlying it, or not like a deep intellectual theory, but it's just it's supposed to be a display of your devotion that you're denying yourself in these ways. So monks are supposed to be, they're supposed to live a life of poverty and the life of charity, and that also makes them dirty and unclean. So in the New Testament, the word common koinos is used for unclean, dirty, unwashed. It's used as a negative term to refer to people that are defiled or profane.
And at some point, doesn't vulgar and common end up being, aren't they? I've heard that. I've heard that vulgar is a term for common at some point, maybe back in the
These
day.
get,
I don't know where that comes from, though.
I think vulgar might be a Latin word, but koinos is used in the New Testament, especially. The New Testament's written in Greek. And so it's used in this negative term. And I mean, this is one of the fundamental tensions in the New Testament. I'm not going to be talking about religion the whole time, but just there's a fundamental tension in the New Testament about common in this sort of negative sense. But then Jesus is always asking people to commune, to have fellowship with each other, sort of communicate with each other. Right, so this is the tension, is how do you communicate with things that are disgusting and vulgar and reviled? So the point here is just that the word Cenobite is supposed to refer to a filthy monk.
Okay, right.
You can think about the sparrow, the high sparrow in Game of Thrones. I don't know.
Right, yeah. Jonathan Pryce.
Jonathan Pryce, very good.
Yeah. That's what happened when he died in the, at the end of Brazil, is that he was reincarnated and brought into the into the Martinverse.
I mean, I guess to be reincarnated in the Martinverse is not so bad, not so bad. So Cenobites have a sort of communal lifestyle where they're sort of religiously devoted to some cause, and it makes them sort of profane in a way, sort of separates them from the rest of the things. Okay, so this is basically how the Cenobites in the Hellraiser universe work.
It's a scene from the movie, or
Yeah, it's a scene from the first movie when the Cenobites first show up, and the Chatterer puts his fingers in Kirstie's mouth. They have this little negotiation. So let me just some of the lines. The Pinhead says, "The box you opened it, we came." She asks, "Who are they?" And Pinhead says, "We're explorers in the further regions of experience, demons to some, angels to others."
you never
So,
see them be angels to anyone, though.
Yeah, good, right. So,
It's a very limited perspective. I was thinking when I was watching this and talking about like the idea of, I mean, not to cut you off, but fine, whatever. Have you seen Star Trek: First Contact? It's the one. It's the one with
it's
the
a Picard
Borg.
one. Yeah.
Yeah, where at one point the Borg Queen, who they're all about collectiveness and all this other stuff, she captures Data, the android, and she actually puts a piece of like skin on him. And she's blowing on the hairs on the skin. And I felt like that's like a more interesting interpretation of like weird pain, pleasure, collective stuff, maybe, than anything in either of the Hellraiser movies in terms of like something you can kind of work with ideologically. But I don't know.
Yeah, no.
Anyway, I mean, I'm saying I think I feel like it's just a weird series. I don't know. I don't know why Pinhead's so iconic. He's in both the two movies for maybe less than 5 minutes, and like the most threatening thing he ever says is, "No, don't do that." I mean, when a lady throws a box out a window or something. But I mean, maybe that's not the point. I mean, there is something horrific going on, obviously. But I just, I mean, I think when people try to maybe, I don't know. I don't know. It's hard for me to see a lot of depth to the Cenobites in terms of what, because you don't actually see it in the movies. You don't see them, you never see a visualization of something that is more representative of what might traditionally be considered a form of pleasure or a sensory, some kind of a more beyond sensory thing. It all just seems to kind of rely on chains and hooks and meat,
Yeah,
which to me
that's
seems
all.
fairly one note. And I know that's kind of what they're dealing with because it's a horror movie ostensibly anyway, but I mean, yeah, so that's where I land with kind of my criticism of the films, I
Yeah,
suppose.
I think you're dead on all of those points. I think you're right that first of all, the Cenobites are flat characters. It's not pleasure and pain, it's just pain, right? And they get pleasure in pain, but that's not the same thing as pleasure and pain. That's just pain, right? So, the way I want to talk about that is that it's a monopole. Hellraiser it's a moral realist universe in the sense that there is one good, and that good is suffering, right? And everything is about suffering for the Cenobites, right? There's not God, there's not a heaven and hell, there's just the hell. So it's a monopole of value. It's a moral realist. Moral realism just means that there are moral facts. I want to describe a Hellraiser universe as a particular kind of moral realist universe. And it has different, certain kinds of pro so three properties. To be a Hellraiser universe, you have these three properties. One is that it's monopole, so it's not good and evil. It's just one pole. It's just good or evil or suffering. You can think of maybe other poles. Maybe greed is a pole. It's a different kind of right? Wall Street. Michael Douglas movie is a movie with that's a moral realist universe, but where the one value is greed. Okay. So, a Hellraiser universe has one pole of value, but there's another thing. There's two other important things. One is that it has to be essentially meritocratic, that people deserve what they get. And in the Hellraiser universe, everyone gets what they deserve. And in fact, if you don't deserve something, then you can argue your way out of it and escape torture. Right? Kirstie does this several times because she doesn't deserve the torture, so she doesn't get it. I'll be talking about these some more, but just to round it out, the third feature of a Hellraiser universe. So Hellraiser universe has one pole of value. It's essentially meritocratic, and there's a hierarchy of agents where some agents are more powerful than others, and that gives them certain kinds of control over other agents. So the Cenobites are more powerful than the humans, and in the second movie, we learn that there's more powerful sort of hierarchies of Cenobites, right? So Dr. Kennard, who isn't, by the way, just about the chains and hooks. In fact, Dr. Kennard doesn't use chains and hooks. He uses like flowers and other sorts of things. It throws knives, right? When there's the fight between Dr. Kennard and the rest of the Cenobites, Dr. Kennard just sort of wipes the floor with the other Cenobites without it really being much of a fight at all. Right? So Dr. Kennard's way more powerful, and that's because he's screwed over a lot more people. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. I don't know if this is making sense so far.
I think you're kind of like you're throwing all of the idea balls into the air on a screen like a Tom Cruise in Minority Report thing, and at some point maybe they're gonna kind of turn into one of those magic eye pictures and we'll see a sailboat.
Yeah, so this should come together. Let me first talk about what happens in the movies, and then talk about how Barker's Cenobites are different from the Filthy Monks. A little bit different from the Filthy Monks. So the first movie, it's really a necrophilia movie. Like the core of the movie is about this Hellraiser who wants to come back to life, and then this woman who's like, slaughtering men to feed him so he comes back to life, and like she's attracted to the guy, but she's also repulsed by his decaying flesh, but she's also attracted to him, and it's really about being attracted to a decaying corpse. It's just necrophilia, that on its own could be a movie by itself. But then there's these weird Cenobites who like really have very little to do with that core plot, except just tangentially. They just sort of poke in tangentially, but they're what makes the whole series, right? That's where the icons are. No one really remembers Frank. Everyone remembers Pinhead. And so Cenobites, you activate the Cenobites by opening the box. And the idea is that people who open the box are curious, right? They're looking for something new, and then what they get are the Cenobites, and Cenobites give them something new. They give them all the tortures that they want. But here's the trick: is that either they destroy you, like they did to Frank, or you like it and you can become a Cenobite, right? If you're really into the torture that you get from Cenobites, you can become a Cenobite, right? Julia's a Hellraiser. Kennard becomes a Cenobite. You can sort of negotiate your way into the Cenobites, right? If you're like someone who's really into the torture, and all of the really good Cenobites are people who enjoyed the torture. Frank didn't enjoy the torture, right? Frank was destroyed, and he wanted back to regular life. He didn't want to become a Cenobite. So the Cenobites are the ones who like doing this, right? So I mean, this is part of the metaphysics. So Leviathan controls everything, and Leviathan is like the Cenobites are the sort of the workers for Leviathan. And they you spread these boxes around, and then the Cenobites like torturing people, but every once in a while you find someone who's good at it and becomes another Cenobite, and so you can sort of expand the ranks of the Cenobites through this procedure, right? So
Yeah, it's a recruiting device.
yeah, it's a recruiting device. And you compared it to the Matrix earlier, and that's right. So in the first movie, Frank is kind of a bug in the system, right? Frank's just trying to escape hell. And Kirstie opens the box, but she's not really curious. She's just trying to find her father. So she's able to negotiate a trade for Frank, right? Because he's a sort of bug in the system, and the Cenobites go and capture him again, right? So they're just doing garbage collection. Right? They're system admins for the Leviathan. And we learn all this in the second one. The way we learn this is through Dr. Kennard, right? So Dr. Kennard has gathered multiple boxes because he wants to understand the powers of hell. He's gathered multiple boxes. He's not going to open them himself because he's not that stupid. But he's has this mental institution where he finds people to open the boxes for him and to be his sort of experimental subjects in his research. So in the process of doing this, Dr. Kennard has fucked over a lot of people. So this is the hierarchy of power for Leviathan. Is to gain power or to escape whatever torture you want to escape, you screw over people, and every person you screw over gives you more power. And so the more, right, so the Cenobites are people who have tortured and killed lots and lots of people, so they have lots of power. Kennard has done even more than that, right? Kennard has done three times that with three boxes and this whole mental institution's worth of people. So when he turns into a Cenobite, he has dramatically more power, right? So the idea is that there's this sort of hierarchy of power that you climb. It's the ladder of Leviathan. There's another Game of Thrones really good reference. The chaos is a ladder quote from Littlefinger. I don't know if you remember that.
I don't remember that, but I think, is that it from one of the earlier seasons or?
Yeah, it's from one of the middle seasons. Littlefinger and Varys are having a discussion about power, about power. And Varys talks about chaos being a pit. You just want to fall off into the pit of chaos. And
Right.
Littlefinger says chaos is not a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Well, it's both. If you can figure out how to use it, then you can climb out of the pit that was created through the chaos, I suppose.
Right. And so and you
So
use.
it becomes about agency then, right?
Yeah, that's right. So excellent, excellent. So the Cenobites are a different kind of agent, right? So there's all the humans with all their human interests, and then there's the Cenobites. Cenobites don't have human interests. Cenobites are interested in suffering and torture, in an extreme form, more so than even any human sadomasochist, right? You're not going to see human sadomasochists like ripping out their throat. So Cenobites are sort of like this sort of, I don't want to say transcendent. It's not that they've raised the level. They're not Ubermensch, but instead they're hyper specific, right? They've picked a thing to do, and they do that extremely well, and they really like doing that, right? So, like you said, it's the chains. If you're not into chains and hooks, then you probably won't like being a Cenobite. But if you're really into chains and hooks, then being a Cenobite is awesome. Right? You have extraordinary power. You can do whatever you want, and you do this one thing really well. So this is the metaphysics of it, right? So Leviathan is this big record keeper of all the debts that people incur with other people. right? Every person you screw over. And right, Leviathan has this big black light that it radiates and circles around it. And when it shines on Dr. Kennard, he's reminded of all the terrible things he's done to all the people, right? It's all the guilty things that he's done, all the terrible things you do to other people. And the idea of this universe is that these things are recorded, they're kept track of. You get power in accord with how hard you climb the ladder, but that's also how far you can fall, right? So that's also how bad you can get tortured. So in other words, it's essentially meritocratic. Now remember, this is a universe where everything's oriented towards suffering. So saying that it's meritocratic isn't a great thing. You wouldn't want to live in the Hellraiser world. But it gives a model of a kind of moral realism that we can talk about, right? So again, to be a Hellraiser universe, you have to have a single pole of value, that there's only good or only evil or only greed or whatever. So a single pole, and it has to be meritocratic, where all the debts are recorded and then all the and they're paid off, right? So everyone gets what they deserve. I mean, you might not get what you deserve immediately, but it'll all come back to you in the end, right? Your hell will be in proportion to what you deserve. And then finally, there's this hierarchy of agents, right? So it's not just that you get what you deserve, but that there's this hierarchy of agents, so that the power that you have, the capacities that you have, are in proportion to what you deserve. Yeah, it's a hierarchy of agents where there's sort of nested agents, where Kennard is the sum total of all the powers that he's sort of Highlander-like, right? Where when you kill a Highlander, you absorb their powers, and the more So Hellraiser's like this, where there's this hierarchy of agents, where they have their powers. So it's not just that everyone gets what they deserve, but that you become a more powerful agent. So there's this sort of caste system of agents. But I want to talk about a hierarchy of agents, hierarchy of agency, that's not about race or class or gender or any of the normal identity categories. And so I want to talk about Cenobites as an identity category. So I'm asking, are you a Cenobite? But I haven't gotten there yet. We'll talk about what a Cenobite is in this universe. But the first question just to ask is, are we living in a Hellraiser universe, right? So a Hellraiser universe has these three properties: single pole of value, essentially meritocratic, hierarchy of agents. And the question is, are we in a Hellraiser universe? So we're obviously not in the actual, the movie Hellraiser universe, because there's not demons in hell torturing people and stuff. But we can ask if our universe has these three properties. Is there a single pole of value? Is it essentially meritocratic? And is there a hierarchy of agents?
I think those latter two are maybe the more straightforward ones, where it seems if you're trying to answer that question, you can see evidence of those. I think that the problematic one is this monopole definition, and that comes become it's like saying if you're going to use good and evil, you're going to talk about dark and light. If you live in a world where what there's only one or the other, then you can't really identify it, because you don't have the contrast or the, I mean, I don't know, if you will, from a philosophical standpoint, you don't establish any kind of dialectic, right?
Well, yeah, no. I mean, these are
So
exactly.
you kind of in a monopolistic world where suffering is the goal, is a top notch, is 10 out of 10, then you still do have that second pole, no matter what you do, where zero is something. And
Yeah,
it's the opposite
good.
of that. And if you are within a spectrum and you're trying to analyze a group, then you're going to have to assign them according to to that spectrum. So there might be less suffering, more suffering. It might all be defined based on that. So you might not define anyone as evil ever. You might, in a world that's mono go good, you might just define them as less good.
Yeah, so that's how
So it's
Aristotle.
kind of
Good.
semantics, you know?
No. Good. I mean, you're thinking about this exactly right. So Aristotle has a view where there's just the good. Everything's oriented towards the good, but just some things don't hit it exactly. His image is of an archer trying to hit a target, and the good is to hit bullseye on the target. But sometimes you don't hit bullseye. Sometimes you hit, right? So you're less good as you get further away from the target.
We can even get back to like the shadows on the cave wall stuff, right? The idea of the platonic forms and things too. Does that kind of work? So the perfect chair.
For Plato, there's also just the good. I mean, Plato isn't as clear about that. Aristotle's very clear that there's just the good, and everything's oriented towards the good, and just some things don't achieve it. But I mean, but you might think that that's not how the world works. You might think that there's really good and then there's really bad, and there's two different sort of attractor points, and some people are attracted to the good, and some people are really attracted to the bad as an attractor, not just that they're less good, but that they're positively bad. Well, yes, I mean, so this is just a question. But we don't have to be moral realists about this. We can be other kinds of realists. So you might think that there's no good or bad orientation in the universe, but maybe there is a direction to the universe, like the direction of entropy, right? So entropy always increases. Second law of thermodynamics, entropy always increases.
You're talking about like natural law now,
Natural
right?
law, right? So, and people think, some scientists think, lots of scientists think that entropy is responsible for the arrow of time, right? Because entropy gives a orientation to the universe, a direction to the universe.
Pretty much, yeah.
So you might think that there's no good or bad pole, but maybe there's a pole towards disorder, towards chaos, as a single pole of orientation.
Have you seen John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness? It's kind of a fun little little movie, but he gets into this idea of kind of the good and evil, and it's the biblical stuff, but it's like done as if it were like a sci-fi fable in a weird way, and it's all about these scientists and people that are like in a trapped in a church doing like tests on this giant glowing green goop, and it starts turning people crazy and things. It's a fun John Carpenter 80s movie in 90 minutes. So you might have fun with it. Prince of Darkness. I think
Yeah,
you might
I
enjoy
should watch that. John Carpenter did The Thing.
Right, he
I
did the
really
thing.
like The Thing. Yeah, so the first question is the universe a monopoly? You said the other two are straightforward, though. That is it meritocratic? Is it a hierarchy of
Well,
agents?
I mean, in terms of like as a question, you could ask, you could have Jay Leno go out there and ask people on the street, and they would have a sense of like, well, yeah, I mean, we live in a world where, I mean, that's the ideology, right? I mean, that's the imperfect Pascal's wager of existence kind of thing, where you're like, I mean, I'll try to live a good life, i.e., good, I work hard and maybe I'm rewarded for it. And, you're not generally going to be rewarded for not doing that. So, I mean, like, that just ends up being sort of, I don't know, I guess the pragmatic approach to
Yeah.
to answer those two questions. And then is there a hierarchy? Well, yeah, and it's usually based on the merit, you would assume, or the talent and achievement, I guess. I mean, there's the varying degrees of bitterness and cynicism that applies to everybody's individual life. I mean, like, we could work Happy Time Harry from that Aqua Teen Hunger Force episode into this too. I mean, nothing was ever his fault, right? It's like, I don't know, I was passed out. I'm not supposed to drink, but I do anyway. And he drives that simpleton, that jiggle billy to commit suicide by the realization that his life is meaningless. I mean, that is still to me one of the most, profound episodes of television. And I kid you not.
Well, so I mean, there's lots of reasons to be concerned about whether things are meritocratic, that people get away with things. There's some
Right.
things that I did wrong that I feel guilty about, but I'm sure there's lots of things that I did wrong. I know there's lots of things that I do wrong that I never think about at all, and it never had any impact on me. So maybe things
Well,
aren't meritocratic in that sense.
like as an honest mistake, like you didn't look left one time when you pulled out and somebody had to slam on their brakes.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's probably lots of instances like that, but more importantly, there's no record keeper that's like keeping tally of all these, right? So Leviathan isn't sitting anywhere, keeping tally of everything and
Right.
using it.
If Santa were real,
Yeah, if Santa were real, then maybe things would be essentially meritocratic like that.
or
But
Robot Santa from Futurama.
we probably don't have, right? So the fact that it's not a monopole, the fact that things are not essentially meritocratic, suggests that this is not a, we do not live in a Hellraiser universe. Maybe that'll help you sleep at night. That we don't live in a Hellraiser universe, but this third one, this hierarchy of agents, that power accrues, and that you get this sort of stratification of agents, where some agents have more power than others. This seems to describe our world, and so I want to talk about Cenobites as a way of describing a hierarchy of agents, and sort of a different identity category. So I'm going to use Cenobites, VYTES, to talk about Cenobite. I'm not going to spell BYTES every time,
Yeah, you don't have to. It's
but
fine.
yeah, but I'm gonna use a sort of a slightly different term to refer to something slightly different than this sort of Cenobites, either in the Barker sense or in the Filthy Monk sense.
Okay.
So the characteristics of Cenobites, as I'm thinking of them, Cenobites love their job. They have a job and they love their job. They do their job,
Right.
and they love doing their job. And doing their job involves following certain rules, and they follow those rules of their own accord. Like, you don't have to instruct them to follow the rules. They want to follow the rules, right? So they have integrity in following the rules. So Cenobites have a job that they love and that they're sort of fully invested as agents in that job. Like, defines who they are as agents.
They're not drones. They're thoughtfully aware of what they're doing.
Yeah, and they love every minute of it, right? Like, it's what they want. They go to sleep at night looking forward to waking up in the morning and doing the same job again. Their identities are invested in their jobs. But even they're thoughtfully invested in their jobs. They don't give a shit about anything else. So any other concern that you might have, Cenobites don't care about that. This makes them sort of inhuman in a way, right? So they're sort of just invested in their job and not in any other more general. Their investment in their job might make them intersect with humans generally in some ways, but they don't share universal human interests. They only have their specific interests. The fact that your interests might intersect with their interests means you can negotiate with them. You could, like Kirsty does with the Cenobites, right? They have an interest in making sure that all their victims are adequately tortured, and if Frank escaped, then they would rather get their victim back. And if Kirsty knows this, then she can offer a trade, right? So they're willing to negotiate. And they have rules that they're following when they do these negotiations. Okay, so Cenobites have these properties. As I'm talking about Cenobites, they have these properties. They love their job. They're fully invested in their job. They don't give a shit about anything else. And that takes them out of the realm of universal human interests. But you can still negotiate with them for whatever interests you have. Final thing that defines Cenobites is the way I'm talking about it, is that they dominate whatever spaces they're in. So when a Cenobite enters the room, then whatever else is going on in the room stops, and everything becomes about whatever their interests are. So the Cenobites in the movies are like this, right? They wanted to be Cenobites. They're doing something that they love. They're really good at it. They fully define their identities in terms of the torture, like this routine of torture that they go through. And you can negotiate with them. In their pursuit of these interests, you can offer them reasons to consider things, and they might take you seriously. And they might do things on your behalf in order to get what they want. But all the rest of it, they don't care about, right? They don't care about how much you don't want to be tortured, and they don't care about who's president or anything like that.
Right.
They just care about they're doing their torture.
But there is sort of a weird sort of humanistic awareness that they have to have in order to be able to negotiate in the first place. Because I feel like there has to be this like, oh no, I didn't mean to open it. And it's like, well, okay, I guess there is, I don't know. I mean, like there's a it's like they're a somewhat flexible bureaucrat or something.
Yeah, so there's something humanistic about it, right? So the way the philosophers talk about this is, there's lots of ways to talk about this, but you might talk about a space of reasons, or offering reasons, the practice of offering reasons. And lots of philosophers talk about the practice of giving reasons and offering reasons. And by reasons, I don't mean like rational, logical thinking. I just mean that you have some motivation for doing what you're doing.
Right.
And when we explain what we do, we often explain our motivations for what we're doing, right? We offer reasons for what we do. So a lot of philosophers take the practice of offering reasons as being constitutive of our humanity. It's what makes us human. And
That makes sense.
you're right. I mean, animals don't give reasons for what they do, right? They just do things. And because the Cenobites are also within the space of reasons, there seems like something human about them. But what I want to say is, no, they don't share any other human interest. The only reason that they are willing to offer reasons at all is because they're pursuing their own interests, and offering reasons can help them do it, right? So in this sense, they're intelligent agents, but they're not humans. So I want to say that what it is to be human is to sort of recognize or empathize or identify with these sort of universal human values that, all humans deserve some modicum of dignity and respect. That they deserve some rights, that they shouldn't be tortured, and these kinds of things. These are the humanistic values.
Okay.
And so to be human is to sort of participate in those things and to be recognized and have some standing in those practices. And the Cenobites don't have that. The Cenobites are doing something completely different. They just overlap with us enough to negotiate with us in certain limited ways. But like offering a Cenobite a plate of food isn't going to warm them over, right? That's not going to help your case. The only thing that's going to help your case is if you can offer them something that they want.
Right. So they still have wants, and that's, I think, where you have a basic sense of negotiation, like you're talking about animals or something. It's like if a lion looks like it wants to eat you, but you can provide it with food, then it will do that. I mean, as opposed to like a natural force where like if you fall off a building, you're gonna go splat, as opposed to, you can't negotiate with gravity, but you can negotiate with even anything that has a, I guess, I don't know, anything that's alive, maybe that's where we're at.
Well, I want to
in a very broad definition of the term.
yeah, I want to make it even broader than that. Kind of what I want to say is that you can negotiate with anything that's a Cenobite, or at
Okay.
least a Cenobite, has at least agency of Cenobite level or better. I'll give you some examples of Cenobites in our world. The one other thing that's sort of not about what the Cenobites value so much, but about how they operate in our spaces is that Cenobites dominate any space that they're in, right? So when Christy opens the box, right, then the walls like back out and all the fog comes in and the lighting changes and the walls start to bleed and this kind of stuff, right? So because the Cenobites are coming, and as soon as the Cenobites enter the room, the whole room changes, the atmosphere of the room changes, everything about the room changes.
They end up creating a home court advantage, if you will.
Yeah, and this is a super important thing about the Cenobites, is that they sort of carry this little bubble of reality around them, so that wherever they
Right.
go, everything's sort of about them. And if you enter their little bubble, then you're in their little world.
They're such fucking narcissists. They'd be
Yeah, good,
late,
right? So,
the worst at parties, right?
well, it depends on what kind of party.
I guess
Some
so.
parties are great at angels to some, demons to others.
Right. Good point.
yeah, so I mean, so the best analog of a Cenobite in this sense is a celebrity, right? So a celebrity, like if you're at a party and a celebrity walks in, then everyone starts talking about the celebrity being there or whatever, or they sort of dominate their spaces. And the more sort of eccentric and extreme the celebrity is, the easier they'll have running for president. I forgot what I was going to say.
Well, no, I mean, I think in the context, so that's just this is an easy one. You got normies like us, like you and me, unremarkable people, and then you got celebrities. And celebrities are the Cenobites, and normal people are the normal people. Now, in the context of Hellraiser, it's a little more confusing because you've basically got Pinhead with an entourage of other sort of lesser known celebrities. And in that case, it might be a little more confusing. I mean, if a celebrity goes to another celebrity's house and it's a big celebrity-filled party, it's just a bunch of Cenobites, that's maybe where you would really see who's the head Cenobite. In the case of this doctor in the second one, you get a sense, oh, he could chop everyone else's head off first, so he wins the day.
Right.
And so, I mean, use that as a metaphor, if you will, for a group of people in a room trying to see who's the best at a party or something, who chops
Right.
everyone's head off, who or cuts them off at the legs or whatever
Right.
first. But in the normal case of a, party, so-and-so knows so-and-so knows so-and-so, and his uncle is going to show, and then that person shows up, you're right. Then everybody's like, oh, how about you?
Sometimes celebrities don't make a big deal about who they are, and sometimes people who aren't very big celebrities can sort of have this little bubble of reality around them. I'm also thinking of like, I don't know, like a very boisterous secretary who completely controls the office, and
Okay.
when she's there, the office has a certain
Doesn't have to be a she. That's a little sexist, but
or he,
okay.
yeah, right. I've been watching Mad Men. The person defines the space, and when they're there, that's how that space is. And when they're not there, it doesn't feel like the same space.
Right. Certain people that quote unquote light up a room, if you will. Pinhead lights up a room.
And it doesn't even have to be lighting it up, though. It could be bringing it down Debbie Downer. Yes. So celebrities are a good sort of first pass at this part of being a Cenobite. But celebrities usually have human interests, and that's why they do things like.
Hang glide or something. Fly helicopters.
So they're not so radically divorced from the rest of the humans. Also, the celebrities don't always love their job in the same way and not fully invested in their job. Sometimes they resent being celebrities. So celebrities really aren't Cenobites in a sense. And one really important thing is that Cenobites aren't necessarily egomaniacs. So we talk about this little bubble of reality, but the bubble of reality doesn't have to be sort of self-interested or selfish. And in fact, the Cenobites sort of lose themselves in their job. They identify themselves with the job, right? So it's not that the Cenobites make everything about themselves. Maybe that's what celebrities do. It's that
Well, this,
the Cenobites make everything about the job. And so Cenobites are agents that can get the job done because it makes everything about that job. If you're in the Clive
right.
Barker movie, the job is just torturing people, so that's not that hard. Especially if you can magic in chains and hooks, it's not that hard to torture people. But
They're like the wolf. They get the job done, and that's all they care about.
Wolf's an excellent example of a Cenobite. Wolf is like a perfect example of a Cenobite, where I mean, and when the wolf enters the room, everything like the wolf is the fucking wolf, right?
Right.
Yeah, excellent example, Philip. And Wolf isn't really a celebrity. I mean, he's a celebrity
He's a
that's whisper.
personality,
He's a
yeah.
personality. Good.
And he has a specific skill set. Another example, maybe like a Liam Neeson running around, breaking Eurotrash's necks or something. I
Yeah, for his daughter.
don't know. They
Yeah.
do one thing, they do it very well or something.
Yeah, and the I mean the, another reason the wolf is a good example is because the wolf really doesn't care about anything else except doing his job well. So he'll leave a family funeral and he'll look at splattered dead bodies and doesn't faze him at all because he's got a job to do, and that's
Right.
right good. I have more examples of Cenobites in the real world that I want to give, but I just wanted to give a little bit of framing for this to talk about the Cthulhu scene. So the question: are you a Cenobite? Identity in the Cthulhu scene. So the Cthulhu scene is from Donna Haraway. Donna Haraway's the Cyborg Manifesto. When she's been talking about the Cthulhu scene, and the idea sort of stems from a critique of this term, the Anthropocene. So the last geological age was the Holocene, and geologists, scientists say that the Holocene's over and we started a new age that's defined, characterized by human activity, and so they call it the Anthropocene.
Okay.
And Haraway and her friends say, well, this isn't really fair. Homo sapiens have been around for hundreds of thousands of years. We've been behaviorally modern for like 80,000 years. It's only been in the last few hundred years that all this environmental change has been happening. And the Homo sapiens were around throughout the Holocene and before that. It's not fair to blame the changes in our climate system to human beings, but it's really should we should surely be blaming it's capitalism. We should call it the Capitalocene. So where the change in climate is characterized by human industrial activity, and human industrial activity isn't the same as human activity. It's a just very recent subset of human activity.
Okay.
So the Capitalocene, but then Haraway says she wants to talk more generally about the Cthulhu scene. So the Cthulhu is like what's his name?
Lovecraft. So you're talking about ancient monsters that
Yeah,
are
the old gods.
unspeakable and in the dimensions and all those things.
Right, the old gods are like big, so they dwell in the Nether, and they're vastly more powerful than anything we can come up with, and they care nothing whatsoever about our interests and causes.
I think you get a little big picture there too, and you could talk about the old gods as a metaphor for industrialization and the concepts of capitalism being the machine, like the bank that forecloses on the Jode farm in the Grapes of Wrath.
Right. So
It's
this,
no
good. Keep going.
human being, right? It's just the
It's
system.
all these machines, right? So this is what Haraway wants to talk about with the Cthulhu scene. It's not just human individual agents. It's not even human communities. It's these big pieces of the machine that aren't operating according to human interests and aren't sensitive to human interests. They don't give a shit about us. But they're doing a job, and they probably do that job very well, right? That's why they're there. And so part of the Cthulhu scene is coming to grips, thinking about these kinds of agents, these sort of radically inhuman agents. When Haraway talks about it, she talks about making these agents our kin, so like making them part of our family. So she says, make kin, not babies. This is the slogan for the Cthulhu scene. She says, kin making is making persons. This is a quote. Kin making is making persons, not necessarily as individuals or as humans. It's making agents. And agents of different skill sets, different power sets. So the reason I want to talk about Cenobites is because I want to talk about different kinds of agents that we have to interact with now, that aren't human agents and don't have specifically human interests. And you can interact, you can negotiate reasons with them in some limited sense, but you can't always appeal to a common humanity because they don't recognize that as a motivating concern.
What's the name of the woman that's developing this?
The Cthulhu scene,
It's
this is
not
Donna Haraway.
Haraway. Okay. Do you think she has a dog?
Yeah, she in fact she wrote a lot about companion animals. She calls them companion animals. She
Okay.
talks about how her dog licks her face, and about the mixing of like microbiota, right? So that her, because we're covered in bacteria,
Right.
and the bacteria that covers her is the bacteria that survived the compatibility with the dog that she makes out with on a regular basis. Yeah, so she talks about companion animals. Like she, this is all. This is exactly what she's talking about. So I want to use Cenobites to talk about radically different kinds of agents in a way that doesn't trigger any of our normal identity categories, and or any of the reasons to be concerned about hierarchies of agents, caste systems, right? So with the Cenobites, if you're not opening the box and if you're not interested in the world of torture that they have to offer, and you aren't sort of screwing people over in order to get in or out of that world, then the Cenobites just have nothing to do with you, and you don't have to worry about them at all, right? The Cenobites aren't lurking around corners because they want to torture people randomly, right? They have a job to do. They're looking for specific kinds of people, and if you're not that person, then you don't have to think about the Cenobites at all.
I mean, that box is easy to open. You open it accidentally. I mean, it's not like there's a warning sign with the box. I mean, there's a sense of that of an ominousness established. The lament configuration at the beginning, you know, the guy goes to an Frank goes to an exotic place, and then he sits around and twiddles with it, and eventually figures out a way to open it. It opens in many different ways. And the second one, you've got the autistic girl or the damaged young woman who's, you know, testing other boxes and puzzles. And so I wonder if it is more of a general, like, apple of knowledge kind of metaphor there, where it's just about curiosity, and then you're punished for curiosity, because Kirstie is able to negotiate with them, but I don't know if she was less able to negotiate if just some random geek off the street happened to walk by and pick up one of these lament configurations and just hit it with their thumb the right way. Are they getting ripped in half and Jesus weeping, or...
Yeah.
The movie doesn't really address that in a way that I find satisfying. They don't show, like, a... you know, an easy example of, like, an innocent accidentally opening the box and then, you know, Pinhead, like, going by and closing it and walking away, you know, disappearing or something.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that it's ambiguous in the movie. When the girl opens it, Pinhead tells all the other Cenobites to stop and not go for her because someone else was the cause for it to be opened.
That's a good point. They do kind of give you that example.
Yeah, so they tell them stuff, and in fact they just ignore her. They just leave her, but they leave the gates of hell open, and then the girl runs in there, and there's sort of like a circus sort of vibe where it looks like there's open circus games and like circus tents and like sort of calliope music in the background, but it's all sort of haunted. And she
it would be calliope music in
yeah,
the hell.
Yeah, and she keeps having to run around corners to see what's next, and you can see that there's a curiosity that they're sort of feeding. But they're not right. They're not letting it go all the way to the point that they're torturing her, right? So they're waiting for her to be more mature, where she's doing it herself.
Yeah.
So I think someone who picks up the box on the street, if they're really interested in doing something, you know, like having a new experience, like the way that someone might want to do a new drug, right? I think those people all get tortured. But I think if you're like the girl who was forced to open the box, or if you're like Kirstie, who was not looking for anything at all except for her father, right? These people are innocent, and so. The Cenobites don't have any particular interest in them, and like when you open the box, they offer you. It's sort of like vampires, or you have to invite the vampire in, right? The vampire can't just bust into your house; you have to invite them in.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to know that they're vampires.
No, and they're very charming, right? They're very seductive, so you really want to invite them in, but it still requires that little bit of negotiation.
Right. Yeah, it's a bit of a locker room lawyer thing.
Yeah.
There, but yeah.
So real world Cenobites. For dealing with the Cthulhu scene. The first thing to say is that if you go into urbandictionary.com, the word Cenobite with a Y is already there. It's been there since 2005. And the definition it gives is a term for a person deep into the pleasures of drugs, club ravers and hardcore narcotics users. Any drug is acceptable. And this fits my definition of Cenobites, I think, right? They have one job and they do it well, right? If you're a heroin addict, right, that's your job.
My job is to do heroin. Yeah, addiction is a good parallel and or subtext for this idea, I think.
Right, where it's
singularly driven to one goal.
Right, and hyper focused on that one thing, and all other interests fade away, except for this one interest. And also that they dominate the space that they're in, right? So if you're the hardcore user, then when you're in that club, it's about doing drugs in that club, right? It becomes about...
You're gonna pass out, and then everyone's gonna have to change, stop what they're doing to deal with you.
Yeah, you force your little bubble of reality on the world around you. So addicted people deep into the pleasures of drugs are an example of Cenobites they're talking about. But here's a better example to talk about the kinds of things that I mean. Self-driving cars.
Okay.
So I want to say self-driving cars are Cenobites, in this important sense. They have one job, they do it well.
To drive the car.
Which
has a variety of things that has to negotiate with the road and blah, 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 blah.
And those things intersect with a bunch of things that we care about, right? They're the same roads that we're driving on. Responding to the same signals that we're driving on, right? So we have to negotiate the same space as these cars and interact with them in that space. And they're responsive to the things that we do in that space, but they're not human beings and they don't listen to these sort of general humanistic reasons. Any reasons that they listen to, you have to sort of train them to listen to those specific reasons. And it's really hard to get them to listen to the right reasons. They're not really that good at driving on roads yet. Right. So, but these are the challenges of the Cthulhu scene, right? negotiating public spaces with these radically alien agents with different capacities than us, different backgrounds and different assumptions than we're using. And we can't interact with them the same way that you interact with another human being, because they're not human beings. And the way that they negotiate the spaces that we share is completely different, right? So self-driving cars, robots, any sort of artificial intelligence is going to fit in the Cenobite, right? So, and the point isn't that these things are egomaniacs or that they're celebrities. It's just that they're these radically alien agents, sort of Cthulhuan machines.
It almost seems to me like the most difficult part is the fundamentalism or the, like, in a monopolistic nature of their goals. And that sense, there is no room for negotiation. And that's all, that's 90% of what human interaction is. I mean, usually it's friendly and straightforward, but sometimes it's as simple as, oh, you have two items? Okay, go ahead and go ahead of me at the grocery store.
Yeah.
Well, as opposed to, I am in front, I go first.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, part of the reason that all that works is because human beings have lots and lots and lots of interests. And
sure,
for most people, a huge number of those interests overlap. So most people have an interest in, you know, keeping a friendly space and being kind to their neighbors and, you know, getting home on time and this kind of stuff. And because of all,
right,
because of the way that all those interests overlap, you get these nice little interactions like you're talking about. But with these Cenobites, like the self-driving car, there's not a whole lot of overlap. There's very, very narrow range of overlap with everyone else's interests. And so it becomes a more challenging task to...
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's not... It's a lack of awareness. It's getting back to that idea, I suppose, of like a purely narcissistic agent or something. You're not aware of anybody else in life.
I guess we've gone this far without saying anything about Trump. I guess we can keep on going with it. Another agent like this is a corporation, right? So it's not just the self-driving cars and the robots, but corporations are also radically inhuman, very narrow interests, but overlap with our interests and often stomp all over our interests. There's some sense in which they dominate any spaces they're in. I'm thinking about logos everywhere.
Okay.
Yeah, the corporations are another kind of radically different agent.
We've got branding, advertising. I mean, these are all, I mean, we're kind of getting out into the weeds at a certain point with some of those things. But I mean, you know, defining spaces is one thing. The question is it singularly driven? I think that seems to be the key to the, what you're talking about here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's the key to this, Haraway, to her sort of thesis is that they're trying to figure out how to coexist with, singularly driven agents in a ever more complicated world.
Yeah.
Is there a goal there? Is there a thesis there? I guess that must be what it is, or.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I'm just naive to try to be looking for some kind of a solution.
No, not the solution. She's just framing it.
Right. Okay.
Well, so I think part of the solution that I want to say is to learn to have this kind of integrity, identity, relation with our
okay.
jobs, right? So, in other words, that we should be more Cenobite-like. Part of the way that we transition into the Cthulhu scene is by becoming Cenobites ourselves.
So you get into like 1984 dystopia type stuff, Brave New World, take a drug, be happy with what you do, that kind of thing?
No, that's not. Take a drug, be happy with what you do is not what the Cenobites do.
Right. But I mean, like, from a human standpoint, I guess the arrival at that point is you're talking about dehumanization of humans if you're talking about humans becoming like Cenobites, right?
Yeah. I'm generally an anti-humanist, so there's lots of ways of talking about this. Maybe the easiest way of talking about this is to imagine in the not so distant future when technological automation, when all the robots take our jobs. And no one has a job
okay.
that they have to do, but we're all getting some basic income that can support ourselves. So then the question is, what do you do? And because you don't have to do anything, and you can do whatever you want, and you know maybe everything's virtual reality, so you can be a dragon on a mountaintop if that's what you want to be.
Okay.
But the idea is that in such a situation, you need to find something that you love to do, that you look forward to do when you wake up, and sort of invest yourself entirely in that thing. So like if you want to be the dragon on the mountaintop, like that's a job to do. People would probably want to go see the dragon on the mountaintop. And it takes a lot of effort to like commit to that lifestyle.
Okay.
If that's
but
what
then you could wake up the next day and decide that you want to be the troll under the bridge.
Well, but then who's going to be the dragon on the mountaintop?
Somebody else might, or it's not your concern, right? I mean, see, that's where, I mean, because you're talking about a pretty severe dehumanization. In one case, you could be talking about this idea of everyone wakes up and what do you want to do with your life, and sky's the limit, and pursue your dream, metaphysical dream of whatever, like you said, being something completely different in any sense of the word. But I don't know. I mean, maybe getting like an Agent Smith kind of quality, like you're gonna find misery in your dream at some point if it's the same dream. I mean, chocolate ice cream might taste good, but chocolate ice cream every day, you get kind of sick of it. So I mean, is that something that's maybe innate in humans? I don't know.
Wait. So when I suggested that if you want to be the dragon on the mountaintop, you said maybe you want to be the troll under the bridge. Part of what it is to be a Cenobite, remember, is to have a kind of integrity about the rules that you follow. You follow a certain set of rules and you sort of
Right.
stick to them, right? So
You have a sense, you're duty bound, if you
you're
will, to
duty
be the
bound, right? You're hell
dragon.
bound. I mean, that's exactly right. So bouncing back and forth between mountain and bridge would not demonstrate that kind of integrity. I mean, unless you did it in like a right, unless it was like a regular thing that, I'll be in the bridge on Tuesdays and alternate Thursdays.
As long as there's rules,
Or as
then
long
you
as there's
can do
rules.
whatever you want.
Yeah, right. So
Right.
yeah, so so and so that we know where you are. We
Right.
know that you're there.
There's stability.
Stability, but not just stability, but a sort of persona that maintains that stability. Right. So this is what it is to be a Cenobite, is to have an identity. That's not just defined, not just by your body, but by your job, by your job, by your task, by what you do.
Okay.
Maybe Don Draper from Mad Men is a good example of this, where he's like completely invested in his job. The rest of his life is completely shit, but he's an ad man, and like when he's in his job, when he's in his element, that's where he shines, and he's sort of fully invested in that, in his work.
Okay. I mean, Draper's pretty complicated, but I get what you mean. Yeah, you're going for, where do you shine in life as a person, as a character, or whatever.
Right, and then investing in that, and then learning to see that as its own reward,
Sure.
at the expense of all the other things, right? So you were worried about the radical dehumanization, and the dehumanization, I mean, dehumanization is the investment of this thing above all else, right? This, the job, whatever, above
Sure.
all else, and that takes you out of the realm of the everyone else. It takes you out of the universal realm.
You are no longer normal. You are
Yeah,
now abnormal.
you're
It's
abnormal.
the Jerry Seinfeld story about the Glenn Miller band looking at the family having a Thanksgiving dinner while they're freezing and soaking wet outside. How could you live like that, right?
Right.
Because they're singularly driven as to be musicians and be creative and be on the road and live this strangely carny Spartan lifestyle, if you will, on some level.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's a good
I think
example.
maybe artists are a good example of a type of Cenobite, baby.
Yeah.
You get in your zone, and that's all you're doing. That's all you want to do.
Yeah, you have moments of being a Cenobite like that, and then you have moments of being a normal person.
Right, yeah.
You're more or less eccentric. So you can talk about this. I mean, so like the ultimate plan for, I mean, that's basically the whole talk. The ultimate plan for this is to talk about different categories of agents classed by their capacities, and then using that to
Okay.
organize larger frameworks on top of that, or is there more and more powerful Cenobites,
Okay.
and then eventually climb the ladder and become Leviathan. That's what happens in the comic books, is that Pinhead launches a revolt and tries to revolt against Leviathan.
So he wants to do something outside of the rules, I guess.
Yeah, he's trying.
I feel like it's all inter it's very interesting narrative stuff. I'd be curious more about some other discussion at some point about where I mean yeah, obviously being able to negotiate with different devices and different entities is an important skill set to have. Understand that a dog's going to behave like a dog and that a driving car is going to behave like a driving car, I guess. But I'm not sure if the whole upshot of the deal is to I mean, what's the Nietzsche quote, right? To deny what is human, blah blah blah. It just seems like it's a futile attempt, even those monks probably had occasional moments of lapse.
So the driving car example is a good example of how we have to be doing something like this in the near future, regardless of how much you like it, right? So the Department of Transportation. No, that's not right. The federal, whatever, not the FDA, whatever, the National Highway Safety, whatever. The people that do the laws about the road.
Leviathan.
Leviathan. They've been putting out new rules for what autonomous cars have to do, and there's different levels of autonomy. There's sort of five levels of autonomy, where the lowest level of autonomy is something like the cruise control on your car. It can't really
Okay.
do very much. It has control over one thing, but it's not very much control. And then level five autonomy is full control, where the human doesn't even have to pay attention to what's going on. The Tesla cars right now are level three autonomy or something like that, where it has to be supervised by a human, and the human has to jump in if anything goes wrong. But Tesla has announced that it's going to get level five autonomy cars. All the cars are going to be level five autonomy, where they can handle themselves without oversight. But even if you have level five autonomy, it doesn't settle how the roads work, right? So you might still, and there's talk about like segregating the autonomous vehicles into their own lane so that they don't interfere with other traffic patterns, cause accidents or whatever. Right? It might be that people end up getting upset at the self-driving cars and like sort of discrimination and cutting them off and so on because they don't like them. They don't like the robots on their roads.
Okay.
This is part of the reason it's separate but equal. And these this is negotiating these kinds of conflicts is about negotiating these different classes of agents who have different interests and overlap in these weird ways. And we're
Okay.
gonna have to figure that out just because these agents are around now. And helping them integrate is about, in some sense, doing the same kind of thing, finding the job that you do it well, centering it around your identity, or you're centering your identity around it. So this isn't like a strict caste system of any definite hierarchy, right? There's no concrete levels. In particular, we're not talking about a meritocratic system where you gain power by the number of people you fuck over, like in the Hellraiser movies. But you can see how certain kinds of agents, their capacities are enhanced by the sort of integration with other agents, right? So me, I have certain capacities, but you give me a cell phone and I have a bunch more capacities, and my agency has improved because of the way that I can incorporate these other. So you can build agents on top of each other. You can sort of scaffold them.
Okay.
And
I don't know that the phone has any agency into itself. I mean, it still seems like it's a tool, right? I mean, it's a device that you can do things with, but if you don't do anything with it, it's just a chunk of material that sits on the ground
it does a bunch of
or.
things by itself. It turns on and off the antenna to save power or whatever. It receives emails for
Well, I
you.
mean, yeah, it's doing, but I mean, are those things really agency? I mean, I guess in a loose term, loose sense, I mean, they're just following programs, which is probably what you're getting at.
Yeah, so I can do things like have automated scripts where it responds to emails, very simple emails, and then you can imagine in the very near future, because the technology's there to do this, where the machine learns from watching my behavior about how I would respond to emails, and then it just starts doing it automatically for me, in my own style, in my own language, and then informing me of what I need to know, like giving me a bullet point summary of what was in the email, but it's handling all the interface stuff for me. Again, it's just a program, but you can see how that's taking on a lot more agency. So,
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
in, so in, in human communities, like in the law, we sometimes have other agents act on our behalf as like a legal guardian. If you're a child, you have your parent needs to sign legal documents for you and so on. You have to have someone else act on your behalf. For
Right.
the infirmed or the mentally infirmed, or whatever, you might need agents to act on your behalf to sign agreements for you. In the business world, you can have other people act on your behalf also. And very soon, we're going to have questions about sort of auto contracting bots acting on behalf of other agents, human agents, and how to sort all that out. Right? These are things that are going to have to be decided soon. And the way that you help this get decided is by becoming more of a Cenobite yourself. By having a stronger sense of the how your identity fits in with the things that you do, right? So not just that you have your identity, that you're given your identity, but that you have your identity in virtue of things that you
So
do.
your upshot is the best way to deal with the emergence of, I don't know, what do you want to call it, disruptive technologies, is to give a shit less.
No.
I mean, it just kind of cut into the chase a little bit there, but like on some level, and just be like, well, what do you want to do? Do you really care about that?
Yeah.
No? Okay, fine. Like, do I really care if when I send you an email, it's a machine telling me back and you never really responded? Maybe I do, maybe I don't. If I did, I would invest more time in that. And if I didn't, whatever. And you know what? I would stop emailing you at some point if it didn't seem like it led to any kind of meaningful human interaction, right?
Well, I'm not saying care.
And that would be fine,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I'm
right?
not saying care less about everything. Care less about some things and care more about other things. But just be specific about what you care about and make sure that they're central to your identity in a way that defines how you behave in the world.
Well, I mean, yeah, it seems like the identity is an accumulation of the things you put your energy behind. So it kind of arises from that behavior in the end anyway.
So you think this is a Hellraiser universe?
Well, I mean, might as well be, right? I mean, the reason that Hellraiser or that any of these narratives or any of these stories work and cling to anybody with people, you know, any people or things become iconic is because they strike something that rings true about the nature of humanity or whatever. I mean, you open a box and monsters come to do things to you. You know, you walk in a room, you do whatever, and something dangerous is going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's like a Pandora's box element to that part of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I'm very old story. I think there's also just a fascination that people have with hell. I was watching the what is that space movie with the spaceship that goes to hell?
Oh, Event Horizon.
I was watching. I think people's interest in it is just that it's a depiction of hell, and people are interested in depictions of hell.
Right. I mean, it does have that extra little spice of the black hole and the quantum physics-y stuff, and that, like, you know, once you try to throw a little bit of pseudoscience in there, you sprinkle it into your horror and and that's what John Carpenter does in Prince of Darkness. Then it's a little bit more, there's a little more, richer meal there. And so you're like, oh my God, I guess if you do start thinking about existence beyond humanity and just in terms of like, what is a black hole doing? Oh my gosh. You know? Oh my gosh.
It really doesn't have to be. So, I mean, this is one of the nice things about Hellraiser is that there's no scientific, it's still just a fantasy. Fantasy world. There's no scientific explanations for anything that happens, but there's still rules for how it works, right? There's still,
right.
I mean, the good fantasy worlds are the worlds that are working. I mean, this is why Game of Thrones is fun, is because all the metaphysics for how all the religions work, it's all worked out in high detail. It's not just arbitrary.